And I'm back to read Hitler's War by David Irving. The chapter is Africa and Stalingrad. Hitler believed he had good reason to face the coming winter with optimism. The harvest had been better than expected. Speer was harnessing Germany's latest industrial might to the mass production of tanks and guns. Under Field Marshal Milch, the Luftwaffe's production lines were being reorganized. The Atlantic coast was being fortified. The Navy was in Norway. The submarines were blocking the Allied convoy routes in the Arctic. On October 1, 1942, Field Marshal Rommel visited him at the Berlin Chancellery. He explained why he had to abandon his offensive against the British El Alamein position in August, attributing it to their air supremacy. Hitler showed him the prototypes of new self-propelled assault guns that Speer had collected at the Chancellery that morning, formidable low-chassis armored vehicles mounting the well-proven 105mm guns. He told Rommel of the new Tiger tanks. He promised to send 40 of them across to Africa, and spoke of a weapon of such appalling power that it would blast a man off his horse 2 miles away. Speer had briefed him on Germany's atomic research efforts some months before. Before leaving for a rest cure in Austria, Rommel wrote to General George Sturm, deputizing for him at El Alamein. Quote, "The Führer has assured me," he wrote, "that he will have all possible reinforcements sent down to the army. Above all, the newest and heaviest tanks, mortars, and anti-tank guns, including the 75mm, 88mm, that is the newest type, and 76.2. For our later attack operation, I think it will be important to be equipped with large numbers of 15cm, 28cm, and 30cm rockets, and the necessary launchers, as well as a huge number of smokescreen generators, 500. End quote. Hitler returned to his headquarters in the Ukraine on October 4th. Halder was finally gone. Zietzler took control of the Eastern Front, while Jodl and the OKW controlled other theaters. A division of responsibility reflected in the war conferences at headquarters. Zietzler toured the Southern Front at once, returned to Vinnytsia, and issued over Hitler's name a string of realistic orders designed to increase the army's fighting strength, not the enemy's. On one occasion, Zietzler warned that unless a certain salient was withdrawn, the troops would lose confidence in their leadership. Hitler thundered at him, quote, "You're just a staff officer. What do you know about the troops?" End quote. Zietzler sharply reminded the Führer that in August 1914 he had gone to war as an infantry ensign, his knapsack on his back and his rifle on his shoulder, to fight in Belgium. Quote, "For bravery in the face of the enemy, I was promoted to lieutenant. I was wounded twice. I think my combat experience is as good as yours." End quote. Hitler instructed the general to proceed and avoided attacking him personally after that. He's got to give as good as you get. Thus, Zietzler's position became entrenched. Keitel, by way of contrast, had long forfeited Hitler's esteem. Hitler took to making, quote-unquote, good-humored fun of his absent commanders. Quote, "The horizon of my field marshals," he would mock, is the size of a lavatory lid," end quote. Field Marshal Keitel did not move a muscle as the others laughed. The next day, however, an adjutant informed Hitler that Zietzler wanted a brief private word with him. He cordially shook the general's hand. Quote, "Mein Führer," said Zietzler, "I, as an army general, I take exception to the language you used about our field marshals. May I ask you not to use expressions like that in my presence again?" End quote. Hitler gave him his hand. Quote, "I thank you." When Antonescu visited him 3 months later, Hitler introduced Zietzler to him with the words, quote, "This is my new chief of general staff, a man of iron nerves and great war experience," end quote. The war had taken on many new dimensions since 1939. In the West, the Allies had initiated commando warfare. These peripheral successes struck a raw nerve in Hitler, Whether the target was a radar site in France or a German oil dump, he showed little inclination to mercy when the commandos were caught. In August, six Britons were captured in North Africa behind the lines. Two of them were wearing German uniforms. Hitler ordered their execution. One saboteur could paralyze a power plant and deprive the Luftwaffe of thousands of tons of aluminum. A commando training manual fell into German hands, with diagrams on how to slit human throats and how to truss prisoners so that a noose around their neck would strangle them if they moved. In September, Hitler was told that the British had machine-gunned the survivors of a sinking German mine layer. On his return to Venice on October 4th, news reached him of a British commando raid on the tiny Channel Island of Sark the night before. The island was guarded only by a rifle company. The commandos had seized five army engineers sleeping in a hotel, manacled them, and then shot and stabbed them to death. Hitler immediately ordered all the prisoners taken at Dieppe manacled as a reprisal. The British proclaimed they would retaliate against the same number of Axis prisoners in their own camps. Hitler drafted a text for the daily OKW communique broadcast on the 7th. Quote, "The terror and sabotage squads of the British and their accomplices act more like bandits than soldiers. In the future, they will be treated as such by the German troops and ruthlessly put down in battle, wheresoever they may appear." End quote. General Jodl urged Hitler to leave it at that. The warning words would alone deter. No need to actually put them into practice. Hitler disagreed. He justified it by referring to the commandos' methods as being outlawed by the Geneva Conventions. Quote, "Captured papers show they are ordered not only to manacle their prisoners, but to kill their defenseless prisoners out of hand the moment they feel such prisoners might become a burden or a hindrance to them in the prosecution of their purposes," end quote. Jodl, unhappily distributing Hitler's order to the commanders on October 19th, urgently warned them not to let it fall into enemy hands. A thirst for revenge also played its part. For example, the record of Hitler's war conference on October 23rd began. Quote, "In reprisal for the fresh British air raid on a casualty clearing station in Africa, the Führer has ordered the immediate execution of the Briton captured during the sabotage attack on the power station at Glomfjord." End quote. A week later, an attempt by six British sailors to destroy the battleship Tirpitz, wintering in a Norwegian fjord, came to grief when their two-man torpedoes were lost in foul weather. Himmler reported to Hitler that all were in plain clothes. Norwegian frontier guards had captured them, but the six had opened fire with concealed weapons and five had escaped into Sweden. Hitler ordered the sixth, a 20-year-old seaman, to be executed. 3 weeks later, the same fate met 14 British commandos sent in a glider to attack a hydroelectric power station in Norway. The target, the Vemork power plant at Rukjen, had been selected because of its importance for the German atomic research program. The Norwegian police rounded up the survivors. In accordance with the new Führer order, all were shot before darkness fell. In the Balkans, a partisan war of unexampled ferocity was raging, thanks to the devious policies of the Italians and the ineptness of the puppet governments that Hitler had established. The Italians had occupied Montenegro and annexed large stretches of the Croatian coastline. In Serbia, the partisans were ruthlessly suppressed by the Germans. But in Croatia, rival armies of guerrillas and bandits roamed the land, robbing, plundering, and murdering. The Chetniks, led by Draža Mihailović, were fighting for the restoration of the monarchy in Yugoslavia. The partisans, led by Tito, were fighting an ineffective campaign against them all, hampered by a lack of adequate weapons. Mussolini's Second Army, commanded by the controversial General Mario Rauta, sided not with the Ustasha, but the Chetniks, even to the extent of arming them against Tito's partisans. The Italians were weaving a tangled web indeed. For Hitler, Croatia was of great strategic importance. Across the country passed the German supply lines to North Africa, and it exported 200,000 tons of bauxite to Germany annually. Order was imperative to the Nazis, but the Italians were suppressing the Croat the quote population and actively shielding the Jews, the very subversive elements against whom the Croatian head of state Poglavnik Ante Pavelić was struggling to apply repressive laws similar to those enforced in Germany. Hitler thrashed out this explosive situation with the Poglavnik in September. He had two divisions in Croatia, and a Croat battalion was already fighting before Stalingrad. More were being trained, an entire foreign legion by the Waffen-SS. But now the Poglavnik, I'll get that word eventually, would need them to restore order in Croatia. All this was the result of Rovato's strange dealings, but Hitler was loath to embarrass Mussolini, and the papers sent down to Rome were stripped of any references that might offend Italian susceptibilities. In private, Hitler regretted the Italians' kid-glove treatment of the Serbs. Only brute force bereft of inhibitions would work. Quote, "On principle, when combating illegals, anything that works is right, and I want that hammered into everybody," he laid down. "This gives everybody the freedom of action they need. If the illegals use women and children as shields, then our officer or NCO must be able to open fire on them without hesitation. What matters is that he gets through and wipes out the illegals," end quote. In August, September, October, and November, Himmler's security forces counted 1,337 dead Russian partisans and executed a further 8,564 taken prisoner. His report to Hitler for the same period listed 16,553 partisan accomplices and suspects, quote-unquote, captured, of which 14,257 were executed. An additional 363,211 Russian Jews were claimed to have been executed under the same heading. As for the German Jews, Goebbels did not mince his language in a talk to senior Berlin journalist on September 23rd, stating that the Jews knew, quote-unquote, with deadly certainty that they were to be deported to the East and, quote, left to their murderous fate, unquote. "They can already sense the inexorable tread of physical annihilation," he added, "and therefore, so long as they live, they inflict damage on the Reich wherever they can," end quote. The deportations from Berlin had resumed. From July 1942 onward, trainloads had begun leaving for the capital, for the camp at Auschwitz, and what was vaguely called the East. Finding the number of Jews remaining, particularly in the legal system, still intolerable, Goebbels suggested declaring them all, quote-unquote, unconditionally ausrottbar, disposable, but the word has a nastier undertone. Otto Thierack, the new Minister of Justice, refused to go along with this. Quote, "So long as the Führer won't allow us to address the broader issue of those with Jewish blood or in-laws," he replied to Goebbels, "we can't carry out an action confined to the legal system." The entire Nazi killing operation was smothered in paper-thin euphemisms and bland letters for the record. Referring to allegations made public by American Jewish leaders in New York on November 30th, Himmler wrote to Gestapo chief Heinrich Müller, remarking for the record that given the high mortality rate in their concentration camps, such rumors were not surprising. Hitler felt that he could look east without qualms. Soon his armies could have their well-earned winter respite. On October 14th, he issued orders for winter positions to be built along the current front line, making rigorous use of prisoners, civilians, and women to aid in their construction. The next day, Field Marshal von Richthofen wrote in his diary, quote, "The Führer was in good humor because of Stalingrad and having got rid of Halder. Particularly affectionate to me, the Führer curses with vehemence and justification the name of List. My operational plans in the Caucasus are approved. I tell him something of our infantry weakness, our tactics, and above all, our difficult terrain. Zietzler is stout and cheerful," end quote. In the last week of October, however, the spirit of Paulus's troops in Stalingrad flagged. Richthofen wrote, quote, "The main reasons lie in the wariness of the combat troops and commanders, and in the army's pedantic tolerance of a ration strength of 12,000 men per division, of whom only 1,000 are actually in the front line. I tell Paulus of this, but he naturally doesn't agree. End quote. The capture of the Caucasian oil fields was impossible before winter. Maykop had been in German hands since August, but the oil wells had been either blown up or cemented over. The Army's Petroleum Brigade reported that a year's reconstruction effort would be needed. German manpower was an equally scarce war commodity. Industry relied on the 6 million foreign workers procured by Hitler's labor dictator, Fritz Sauckel. Speer promised to raise 3 divisions from German munitions workers, but the divisions never materialized. The army itself claimed to be 1 million men under strength. Hitler ordered both the Navy and the Luftwaffe to transfer manpower to the anemic army. Goering decided to create 20 Luftwaffe field divisions rather than see 220,000 airmen forced into the army's reactionary field gray ranks. Coupled with these manpower and materials shortages was the complete bankruptcy of Hitler's intelligence services by the autumn of 1942. Colonel Reinhard Gehlen's army intelligence consistently predicted that the next Russian offensive would open not in the south at Stalingrad, but against Smolensk or even Veliki Luki, on the northern front. Admiral Wilhelm Canaris produced equally convincing evidence that the Allies were planning a second front, not, for example, in North Africa, but against the Cherbourg Peninsula. Moreover, Hitler was still misled as to Stalin's coming strength. On October 21st, Keitel said, quote, "The Führer is convinced the Russians are collapsing. He says that 20 million will have to starve," end quote. Yet he did not accept Gehlen's judgment willingly. By October 26th, he was clearly rattled by concrete evidence of Russian plans to cross the Don just where the Axis front was weakest, held only by the reluctant Italians and Romanians. The army group interpreted the dense night traffic toward Serafimovich as unimportant local replenishments, but when the enemy started constructing heavy bridges across the Don, Hitler knew differently. He had built bridges across rivers himself and knew what it presaged. On November 6th, Gehlen reiterated that there were no signs of any Soviet offensive in the south in the near future. Far more likely was a drive against Smolensk, followed by a thrust to the Baltic to cut off the whole of Army Group North. In the south, the logistical and transport difficulties would surely dissuade them. Nor, stated Gehlen, would the Russian offensive begin before the ground froze over. Hitler equally saw no cause to suspect that the North African theater would soon be in an uproar. Rommel was in Germany on sick leave. He had told Hitler that his Al-Alamein position was virtually impregnable, but late on October 23rd, General Montgomery launched an unheralded attack on it with 150,000 men supported by over 1,000 tanks and 800 planes. Rommel's stand-in, General Stumme, was killed evidently by a heart attack. Hurrying back to Africa, the field marshal found his army's fuel and ammunition almost at an end. Despite the Luftwaffe's around-the-clock bombing of Malta, the Axis supply convoys to North Africa had been cut to pieces. Thanks to British code breaking, every single tanker had been detected in time, tracked down, and mercilessly sunk. The Luftwaffe commander in the Mediterranean wrote in his diary, quote, "A crisis of undreamed of proportions has emerged for the Panzer Army. The failure of the Italian fighter escort is to blame. It just did not show up. Kesselring came, worried out of his mind. Lunch was like in a mortuary. Everybody's hopes were pinned on the second tanker, which sailed on October 28th. In the night, it was reported sunk." End quote. For a time, both Rommel and Kesselring were confident that the Alamein crisis had been overcome. Hitler willingly believed them. On November 2nd, however, the line was breached. In his interim report, received by the OKW that evening, Rommel suddenly sounded despondent and anxious. Quote, "The army will no longer be capable of impeding the strong enemy tank formations expected to repeat their breakthrough attempt tonight or tomorrow. Our want of motor transport For want of motor transport, it will not be possible for the 6 Italian and 2 German non-motorized divisions to withdraw in good order. Even our mobile troops are embroiled in such heavy fighting that only part will be able to disengage themselves from the enemy. Our meager fuel supplies will not permit any withdrawals over long distances. In this situation, the gradual destruction of the army must therefore be assumed as inevitable, despite the heroic resistance and exemplary spirit of the troops. S.G.D. Rommel, Field Marshal. End quote. In fact, Rommel had already ordered his army to abandon El Alamein, without notifying anybody to that effect. To cover himself, Rommel later dispatched to his superiors a lengthy but seemingly routine daily report, near the end of which he surreptitiously buried the announcement that he would withdraw from El Alamein the next day, November 3rd. Quote, the infantry divisions will already be withdrawing during the coming night, November 2nd to 3rd. End quote. This routine report arrived by teletype at the Führer's headquarters at 3 a.m. Jodl's night duty officer, an elderly major of the reserve, overlooked the vital sentence announcing the retreat and left the report unforwarded until morning. Jodl's deputy, General Walter Varlamont, discovered it too late. It was belatedly rushed over to Hitler at 9 a.m. For a time, he suspected that the OKW had deliberately sat on Rommel's report in order to confront him with a fait accompli in Africa. Quote, at this critical moment, Rommel turned to me and the Fatherland. Turned to me and the Fatherland, he exclaimed. We should have been stiffening his resolve. If I'd been awakened, I would have taken full responsibility and ordered him to stand fast. But our Mr. Varlamont is snug asleep while Rommel is appealing to me. End quote. The night duty officer was fetched. Hitler questioned him in person. Rommel was also interrogated by radio, asked to state the precise time that the infantry retreat had begun. He radioed back, quote, in the latter part of the night, so it seemed that for the report's inexcusable delay, Hitler could still have stepped in to forbid the retreat. Punishment was swift. The major was reduced to the ranks and sent to the front. His superior, Varlamont, was evicted from the OKW and the Führer's headquarters that same day. But Rommel's reply was a lie. His retreat had begun at 10 p.m., before his report had been dispatched. Hitler believed he could still give Rommel the inspiration he seemed to be begging for, and he radioed to Rommel the following message, finely attuned to the susceptibilities of the field marshal. Quote, with me, the entire German people is watching your heroic defensive battle in Egypt, with rightful confidence in your leadership qualities and the courage of your German and Italian troops. In your situation, there can be no thought but of persevering, of yielding not one yard, and of hurling every gun and every fighting man available into battle. Considerable Air Force reinforcements are being transferred over the coming days to Commander-in-Chief South, which is Kesselring. The Duce and the Commando Supremo will also do their utmost to furnish you with the means to keep up the fight. Despite his superiority, the enemy must also be at the end of his strength. It would not be the first time in history that the stronger will has triumphed over the stronger battalions of an enemy. To your troops, therefore, you can offer no other path than that leading to victory or death. SGD Adolf Hitler, end quote. Rommel rescinded his order to retreat, but already it was too late. As November 3rd ended, he had only 24 tanks left. The next day, he reported that the battlefront no longer existed and formally asked permission to revert to mobile warfare until the new line at Fuka was reached. Hitler sourly replied that evening, quote, in view of the way things have gone, I approve your decision, end quote. He felt Rommel's nerve had failed him. 2 years later, he brooded, quote, he should have stood his ground up front at El Alamein, but that was his only chance of saving anything. He didn't compensate for the enemy's superiority of numbers by heading for the wide open spaces. That was where their superiority really began to take effect. At that bottleneck just 40 miles across, you could just about survive an attack. But the moment you were forced out and lost the cover of the Katara, depression to your left. All the lessons of desert warfare showed you were liable to be leapfrogged again and again by the enemy. End quote. Too late, Hitler ordered reinforcements rushed to North Africa. The deadly tiger tanks, guns, ammunition, fuel, two fighter squadrons from Russia, and a bomber squadron from Norway. In Africa, a rout had begun, one that was to end dismally in Tunis 6 months later. While at the southern end of the Eastern Front, the First Panzer Army's advance on Orzhonikidze was going well. In Stalingrad, the infantry was losing heart as the weeks now became months. Field Marshal von Richthofen was to note in his diary in mid-November, quote, telephoned Zietzler about the need for a really energetic leadership in the battle for Stalingrad, or for the attack to be called off otherwise. If the mopping up is not done now, with the Volga icing over and the ice and the Russians in Stalingrad in dire distress, we will never pull it off. Besides, the days are getting shorter and the weather worse. Zietzler promised to tell the Führer. He shares my view. During the night, a Führer order came to the 6th Army in line with my telephone suggestion. But I still don't think it will work. I stressed to Zietzler that the commanders and combat troops in Stalingrad are so apathetic that only the injection of a new spirit will get us anywhere. End quote. Hitler was still hypnotized by the obvious Russian preparations north of Stalingrad. The OKW historian recorded on November 2nd, quote, the Russian attack feared across the Don toward Rostov is again discussed. More and more Russian bridges are being built there. The Luftwaffe is to submit reconnaissance mosaics. The Führer orders very heavy air attacks on the bridge sites and troop assembly areas suspected in the forests on the other river bank. Soon after, 2,000 enemy vehicles were glimpsed massing north of Kletsia and the headquarters of... that was the end of the quote. Soon after, 2,000 enemy vehicles were glimpsed massing north of Kletskaya and the headquarters of a new Russian army group, the quote-unquote Southwest Front, was detected at nearby Serafimovich. Throughout October 1942, the Abwehr and SS intelligence agencies had been swamped with quote-unquote enemy invasion plans. Some spoke of Norway, others of the Channel Coast or the Mediterranean. A further military setback here might force Italy out of the war. The whiff of treason was already in the air. Hitler's military liaison reported on November 6th that Mussolini thought the time now ripe to make amends to Stalin. Hitler believed he could postpone his next meeting with the tired and ailing fascist dictator no longer. Besides, he had gradually become aware that an immense fleet of Allied ships was assembling at Gibraltar. Hitler had recently suspected that the enemy would invade Sardinia or Corsica prior to striking at the Italian mainland itself. Much of the Luftwaffe's strength had been withdrawn eastward from Sicily, but Hitler had ordered all available German submarines to the western Mediterranean. The Navy insisted that the enemy was just preparing to fight a big supply convoy through to Malta. On the 6th, they changed their tune. The Armada had sailed, and Italian intelligence now reported that the vessels had trucks and invasion tackle on their docks, and they were joining convoys of ships streaming eastward through the Strait of Gibraltar. The Navy judged that the enemy planned to invade Libya in Rommel's rear. Though both Mussolini and the Luftwaffe believed an enemy invasion of Algeria far more likely, beyond the range of the Axis air power, Hitler had by November 7th bowed to the Navy's judgment that the likely targets were Tripoli or Benghazi, and he personally radioed to the handful of submarines and torpedo boats in the Mediterranean, quote, Army survival in Africa depends on destruction of British naval forces. I expect determined, victorious attack, end quote. Early in the afternoon of November 7th, Hitler's train left Rostenburg for Berlin and Munich, where he was to meet the Italians. At a 7 p.m. war conference, Jodl briefed him on the latest position of the enemy armada in the Mediterranean. It was still heading due east and would probably pass through the Strait of Sicily. Toward the end of the conference, the naval staff telephoned with confirmation. From the Armada's 6 p.m. position and the ship's speeds, the Italians deduced that it must be an invasion of Algeria. Hitler accepted this calculation. It was a bitter pill to swallow, and his disappointment at his intelligence agencies must have been profound. But he remained outwardly calm and detached. His train was halted by a signal at a little railroad station deep in the Thuringian forest. British radio stations, a message here said, were announcing that an American invasion force was disembarking on French Northwest Africa at Algiers, Oran, and Casablanca. And there's an asterisk note here. The various enemy invasion convoys had suddenly headed sharply south, soon after the Italian sightings at 6 p.m. As Hitler sourly pointed out in April 1944, quote, "The few invasions they have carried out so far completely escaped our notice. Take the North African invasion," end quote. And Keitel agreed, quote, We were saying right up to the last moment that they'd sail on through. Their vanguard was off Sicily, and we said they were going right on through. Then all at once they made a right about turn and did a beeline for the shore," end quote. That's the end of the asterisk. At Bamberg railroad station, Ribbentrop stepped aboard Hitler's train. He had hastily flown down from Berlin after arranging for Count Ciano to come at once to Munich. Mussolini being indisposed. Hitler wanted to discuss his new opportunity of reversing Germany's policies toward France, but Ribbentrop brimmed with gloomier topics. The entire Axis position in the Mediterranean was endangered, unless Hitler could let up on commitments elsewhere. Quote, "Give me permission to put out peace feelers to Stalin via his ambassadors in Stockholm, Madame Collante. End quote, appealed Ribbentrop. And quoting again, "Even if we have to sacrifice virtually everything we have conquered in the East," end quote. Hitler rose angrily to his feet, reddened, and refused to discuss anything but North Africa. A momentary military weakness was no time in which to put out peace feelers to an enemy poised to strike. At 3:40 p.m. on the 8th, the train pulled into Munich. As always, the actual occurrence of the feared event had lifted the torturing burden of uncertainty. At last he knew where the second front was, and it was not the European mainland. Now he must airlift troops to Tunisia to bar the American advance. Now France must join the Axis cause. At 6 o'clock, in a buoyant mood, he delivered his anniversary speech to the party's old guard at the Lohenbrückkeller in Munich. He reminded them yet again of his 1939 Reichstag prophecy concerning the fate of the Jews. Quote, "Of those who laughed then, countless already laugh no longer today." End quote. He mocked. Okay, that's it, period. Believing a message from the chief of staff of Army Group B, Hitler boasted that Stalingrad was virtually theirs. Quote, "I wanted to reach the Volga at a particular spot at a particular city. By coincidence, it is blessed with Stalin's name. It is a vitally important city because there you can cut off 30 million tons of river transport, including 9 million tons of oil. It is there that the grain of the mighty Ukrainian and Kuban regions flows in for transportation to the north. There the manganese ore is processed. It was a huge shipment complex. That was what I wanted to capture, and do you know, modest as we are, we've got it too. There are only a few more tiny pockets. Now some may say, then why don't you fight faster? Because I don't want a second Verdun, that's why." End quote. Hitler's newfound fondness toward the French, inspired by glowing accounts of the fierce fight put up by French warships defending Casablanca and Oran against the American invaders, lasted less than one day. He began to suspect the French commanders were trying to make a deal with the enemy. On November 8th, he had still believed General Henri Honoré Girard to be in France. The next day, he found out that Girard had slipped across to Gibraltar aboard an enemy submarine to act for Eisenhower in Algiers. Hitler's fury at Girard's escape was matched by his contempt for Himmler's secret agents, who had failed to prevent it. By the time Count Ciano was ushered into his study at the Führer building in Munich late on the 9th, Hitler's old hostility toward France had rekindled in full. He snapped at the Italian foreign minister that he had decided to occupy the rest of France. Whatever France's Premier Laval, due at 10 p.m., might say, Hitler's mind was already made up. His troops were already amassing along the demarcation line in France. Quote, strike, 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 end quote. It was the old Prussian remedy when all else failed. Laval was delayed by fog. His car arrived in the small hours of the night. Hitler postponed seeing him throughout the 10th. He was seen deep in the conference with Ribbentrop, Himmler, and the generals discussing the intelligence reports. Himmler's agents at Vichy had intercepted Darlan's message to Bataille during the night demanding the execution of renegade officers. But the SS agents also learned that Darlan's staff was preparing to leave Vichy and that all his war ministry files were being burned. At midday, Darlan's name appeared on an order for all resistance to the Allies to cease. The luckless Laval was received now with barely concealed brusqueness. Hitler told him of his demands for immediate access to Tunis. At 20 past 8 that evening, Hitler issued the order for his troops to occupy the rest of France the next morning. It stated that the quote-unquote, or no, it's a big quote, it's a big quote. It stated that the, quote, occupation is being carried out in accord with the wishes of the French government, end quote. Quote, just like Otto in 1938, the Luftwaffe generals in Paris asked General Jeschenik in Munich. Jawohl, he replied, just like Austria. This time there were no cheering crowds. The real French hatred was reserved for the Italians occupying Corsica and the Riviera and arriving in Tunisia in the wake of the Germans. The Italians in southern France overstepped the lines agreed on with the French, and Hitler learned that Laval had been overheard on the 12th shouting into a telephone that if Italy did not withdraw her troops in 24 hours, he would declare war on her. The Italian shenanigans drove Hitler's last few supporters in France into open hostility. Great job, Italy. A member of Jodl's staff reported, however, late on November 14th, quote, the Führer's actions are governed by his consideration for Italy. He believes it absolutely vital to bolster the Duce in every way we can, and this is why he categorically refuses to oppose Italy's claim to leadership in the Mediterranean, including the coast of southern France, or to present the Italians with fait accompli. End quote. Operation Brown, the hasty creation of an Axis bridgehead in Tunisia, went well, but on November 12th, the rest of the French forces in North Africa capitulated to the enemy. For 2 weeks, Hitler simulated trust in the French navy. He had no option, as he had no military means of detaining the French fleet of 3 battleships and over 30 destroyers at Toulon. He therefore accepted the promises of the Navy's admirals not to open hostile action against the Axis. Silently, however, Hitler prepared for the worst. A Luftwaffe general noted on November 16th, quote, the Führer fears the French will create an enclave paving the way for an Anglo-American invasion that must be prevented, end quote. The Germans also learned to their chagrin that the apparently senile Bataille could have been communicating secretly with Darlan all the time by underwater cable, so much for his protestations of loyalty broadcast by radio. Hitler ordered the Luftwaffe to stand by in case the French fleet suddenly set sail, and on November 18th, he decided to make a clean sweep. A date was set 8 days hence to overrun the Toulon enclave. Mussolini was not informed, but in spite of Raeder's frantic objections, Hitler stipulated that the Italians should nonetheless be given the Toulon dockyard, and the French fleet, or whatever remained of it. The operation began before dawn on the 27th. By noon, the French fleet at Toulon no longer existed, its battleships blazing, stranded hulks, all but a handful of the rest scuttled or blown up. Hitler gave the Italians the wreckage to pick over. Throughout occupied France, new painted slogans appeared overnight on the walls. Viva l'Amérique, and patriotically, 1918. Germany's defeat was regarded as a certainty now. Hitler resigned himself to a long stay at the Berghof. He badly needed respite. In Germany, too, the public stoically steeled itself for eventual defeat. The diplomats again hinted that this was their last chance to extend feelers towards Stalin, while the Red Army was still being held at bay. But it was not. On November 19th, 1942, the phone rang at the Berghof, and General Kurt Zietzler, chief of the General Staff, fighting an almost forgotten war from his headquarters in East Prussia, came on the line. A heavy artillery bombardment had begun on the Don front north of Stalingrad. Masses of tanks, black with Russian troops, were swarming forward. The Romanians were in full flight. It was all happening just where Hitler had predicted. The next day, another offensive started, this time south of the city. 2 days later, Stalingrad was encircled, and the fiercest drama of the war began. End quote. This is where they're about to lose thousands of troops in Stalingrad to Stalin.